Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of September 1st. We're back on our weekly schedule now, and we're pleased to be joined by Sister Regina Bechtel, author of the article from the September 1st issue called An American Daughter, Elizabeth Ann Seton and the Birth of the U.S. Church. Welcome, Sister Regina.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, maybe you can introduce yourself to our listeners.
Surely. I'm officially the Charism Resource Director for my community, which is a big title, which simply means that I get to develop programs and resources that share the story of Elizabeth Ann Seton and the Sisters of Charity and the spirituality that is part of her heritage and part of the tradition that we live in.
Now, this is an article. It's in 2008. Why revisit the story of Elizabeth Ann Seton right now?
Well, this is a particularly big year, as you know, for the for five dioceses in the U.S., and it was the bicentennial year for the New York Archdiocese and Boston and Philadelphia and Bardstown, Kentucky, as well as the Archdiocese of Baltimore. And Elizabeth Ann Seton, in that maturing American church, was an important figure. She knew many of the key players in that story of the growing American church. And next year will mark the 200th year since she founded the Sisters of Charity in Emmitsburg, Maryland.
Now, maybe we can back up a little bit and look at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton's life before she converted, before, you know, obviously founding the Sisters of Charity.
She was a quintessential New Yorker. She was a child of the American Revolution. She was born in 1774 and as a British subject, and then she became an American when the Revolutionary War began and continued. She was a Protestant Episcopal child and a member of the social elite in New York. Her father was the health officer of the Port of New York, and her grandfather was a rector of the Protestant Episcopal Church, St. Andrew's, on Staten Island. And so she had a heritage, a background of care for others, care for the poor particularly. And then she married into a prominent merchant family, the Setons, and really was part of the society of New York at the time. She went to a birthday ball for George Washington, which her husband helped to plan. And her father-in-law, William Seton, was one of the founders of the Bank of New York, so very involved in the finance of New York at the time. So from that prominence, fortunes failed with Napoleonic Wars, etc., and her husband's business began to fail. And actually, they went into bankruptcy. Certainly, that's a situation that folks today can relate to. She traveled then to Italy with her husband in hopes of regaining his health. And in fact, that turned out just the opposite because he died there. And then that gets into the story of her conversion.
Right. Yeah, that was my next question is, you know, somebody in 18th century New York, 19th century New York has very little contact, I would presume, with Catholics. Mm-hmm. So what precipitated her conversion? Was it the move to Italy?
Basically, yes. Certainly when she was in New York as a prominent socialite, wife and mother, she was involved in a benevolent organization that helped poor widows with small children. And probably many of the people she met were immigrant Catholics. But I doubt that she had any real contact with the faith there. When she went to Italy and her husband died, she was literally taken in. She and her eldest daughter were taken in by business associates of her husband, the Felici family, who were well-educated Catholics, prominent people in Livorno and Pisa, Italy. And it was their devotion and their introducing of her to Catholicism by visiting churches. She was taken in by the splendor, the beauty, the art, you know, of the churches of Italy. And particularly there, she met a real sense of the presence of Christ in the Eucharist that she had always been drawn to in her own Episcopalian tradition, but in Italy she really came against that full force. So that intrigued her. Catholicism began to intrigue her, and the Filikis drew in the line. You know, they cast the hook and drew in the line. They truly brought her knowledge of the faith. And when she came home, she was still in the state of indecision, but she eventually became a Catholic.
Now, when she returned to the United States, as you chronicle in your piece, she had a number of mentors, people who kind of nourished her vocation.
Yes.
Some within the hierarchy, correct?
Indeed, and it's that connection that I think is particularly significant. She corresponded with churchmen in Boston, John Chevreux, who later became bishop, and Father Matignon. She made the acquaintance, again through contacts in New York, made the acquaintance of Archbishop Carroll in Baltimore, corresponded with him, and when she was trying to make up her mind about becoming a Catholic, she received very sage advice from both of them. She also considered going to Montreal at one point and starting or working in a school there and providing for her boys. I mean, she was always trying to figure out how to take care of her family as an impoverished widow. So she received both advice and financial help from some of her American benefactors, many of whom were among the clergy.
And she eventually wound up moving from New York down to the Maryland area, and that's where the order was founded.
Yes, that's right. That's where the story begins, really, in the article in America. She's leaving New York, going to Baltimore at the invitation of a Sulpician priest, Father Dubourg. The Sulpicians had settled in Baltimore and were building a seminary there, and somewhat rivaling Georgetown in Washington, D.C., they were also beginning a school for boys. Father Dubourg invited Elizabeth to come down to Baltimore, a place that was much more hospitable to Catholics, and open a school for girls there. And she leapt at the opportunity, went to Baltimore, stayed there only about a year, when she was then given property in the Emmitsburg farmland, farm country, Maryland, about 50 miles northwest of Baltimore. And that's where she settled and began the Sisters of Charity.
And that would have been in 1809.
That was 1809, yes. And at that point, it was the first native religious community in the United States.
Now, maybe we could talk a bit about her legacy and her particular brand of ministry. Her story is, you know, obviously she was married, she had children, and then she entered the religious life. How did that experience, being married, having a family, shape her ministry?
It shaped it profoundly, I think. She, early in her life, she spoke about her world was her family, and she was really a devoted wife and mother. She loved her husband deeply. One delightful letter in her early years says that she tucked a picture of herself into his luggage when he was traveling, you know, so he would remember her. She had this deeply relational quality about her, this charm, this desire to reach out to others. I think her married life certainly made her comfortable with men, both lay and clerical, and she counted men among her dear friends throughout her life. They were charmed by her. She had that way about her, I think, of winning them over. I think, too, the fact that she was a mother of five children, she brought a mother's wise heart and common sense to the students that she met and to her community. She said things like, tenderness is the language children best understand, and if the heart is lost, all is lost. She had a way of shaping her educational methodology in a way that really attracted and sought to form the whole person, not just the mind.
Now, you brought some pictures with you, and maybe we can put one of these up online for our listeners, but there's one in particular that's quite striking of her around the time when she was married. And the pictures I always remember seeing growing up, going to a school that was run by the Sisters of Charity, you see her in her full habit. But here's one where her hair is a little unruly, and she looks, you know, very young and almost passionate.
Yes. Well, when we do tours for the students in elementary schools and high schools, we always show them this picture and say that she's kind of having a bad hair day. But actually, it was a fashionable, you know, mode of dress at the time. She's 19 years old. She's just about on the verge of her marriage. Her dark brown eyes are flashing, and she looks as though she could conquer the world, and she's ready for anything. I think there's a passion that comes through her in this picture. It happens to be a miniature, a sort of a cameo type of setting that was painted of her and also of her husband, and they exchanged it at the time of their marriage. And the originals of those actually are in a museum in the archives of the Sisters of Charity at Mount St. Vincent in Riverdale, New York.
And you had mentioned earlier to me that that is open. If you make an appointment, somebody can visit.
Yes, certainly. Just go online to our website and www.scny.org, and you can find ways to visit.
Now, you hinted at this before. Here was a woman, 19th century America. Obviously, women were not in many positions of power. How did she do it? You know, here's a woman not only in a patriarchal society, but within the patriarchal institution of the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. How was she able to accomplish as much as she did?
Well, that's a great question. I must say, much as I would like to, I can't say she was a feminist. You know, it just doesn't fit her, because her sense of women's roles was typical of women of her era. Her world was her family, as I said. She wanted her students to become good wives and mothers. She had a sense that the woman's place was to shape the moral life of the family, and thus to, you know, influence the world. And yet, with all of that, she was living at a time when the role of women was changing, and there was much more moving out of women into, if not the public sphere, at least sort of a middle sphere. And her work in the Widows Society for the Relief of Widows with Small Children, imagine that on your letterhead. she was a charter member of that society that began in 1797 in New York by a woman named Isabella Graham. And they did incredible kinds of things. They visited the poor widows, immigrant women in their homes. They attempted to find jobs for them, and they actually had sort of an entrepreneurial thing going where they found people who needed laundry done and made sure that the laundry got to the widows, and the widows took care of it and then brought it back to the persons who then paid them. They started a school for the children. They petitioned the legislature to give them money to buy property so they could provide housing. So this benevolent society, I think, was a powerful way that women of her time were able to influence public policy and do good for people in need. And she carried over much of that sense of knowing that she had the power to influence and to change social situations through avenues that were typically open to women at her time, through education, through care of orphans, and through what eventually became through nursing and health care.
Now, of course, we know that Saint Elizabeth Ann Seton was the first native-born American saint. What is it about her story that is uniquely American?
She grew up with the country. I think that's one thing that strikes me. She's ours. She is a New Yorker. She walked our streets. The home, one of the homes where she lived in Manhattan, is still there. It's now the Church of Our Lady of the Rosary at the very tip of Manhattan by the Battery. And in its day, it was a prestigious address. So physically, she's part of us. Her Protestant roots, her American Protestant roots, and that whole sense of religious pluralism, of toleration, of separation of church and state that was at the foundation of the American ideal, was hers as well. On the other side of it, too, she also experienced the religious prejudice that is part of the American fabric and has been and continues even in our day. The nativist or anti-immigrant, anti-poor, often anti-Catholic sentiment after she became a Catholic. I think another facet that marks her as an American is her intrepid spirit, her can-do spirit. She adopted the Seton family motto, which is hazard yet forward. You know, at any risk, yet go ahead. And that characterizes her life. You know, amid tragedies, amid setbacks, she lost two of her daughters to an early death from tuberculosis. So that intrepid spirit, coupled with a remarkable faith and trust in divine providence, I think is typically American. And also, lastly, she shared Archbishop Carroll's desire, which was to make Catholicism intelligible to Americans and vice versa. And I think she cooperated with him, she partnered with him in his dream to do that, to make Catholicism part of the American fabric through education, first of girls, which was sorely needed, and then through other charitable works.
Of course, you know, we're all familiar, those of us who grew up in the Northeast, of the legacy of the Sisters of Charity and the hospitals and many, many schools that they ran. Now, given, of course, that Sisters, like other orders, are facing a decline in vocations, how is the order continuing Mother Seton's work today?
Well, the legacy that Elizabeth Seton leaves us, and actually from before Elizabeth Seton, St. Vincent de Paul and St. Louise de Marillac, whose rule Elizabeth Seton adopted, that legacy is to give every service in our power. And as our numbers decline, the mission, the impetus still is there, even though the numbers may be less, maybe fewer. One of the ways that we seek to continue our mission is to make lots of efforts to partner with our lay colleagues in our institutions. I mean, that's been part of our work from the beginning, collaboration. We never could do it alone, and we never did do it alone. But today we have many of our charity congregations. There are at least four different groups in the tri-state area, in New York area. We have lay associates who share our ministry and share our spirit from within their own walks of life. We try deeply to foster a sense of our a partnership in the mission with our lay colleagues in school faculties and hospital and social service agencies. We are still serving in many different ways, still serving women, children, immigrants, the poor on every level. We see ourselves as servants of the mission, and somehow God is going to make sure the mission continues, and often in ways that we did not expect, and with partners whom we did not expect, but we're delighted and grateful to welcome others into our mission.
Now we're looking forward to 2009 and the bicentennial celebration. Maybe you can give us kind of a brief summary of what's planned for that celebration.
Well, yes, as I mentioned, there are four congregations: the New York Charities, the Sisters of Charity of Convent Station, New Jersey, the Halifax Sisters of Charity, and the Daughters of Charity from in the New York area. And I can tell you some of the things that we're planning. Certainly, we'll have some kind of a Vesper service down at the Shrine of Elizabeth Seton at Our Lady of the Rosary Church on State Street in early January. January 4th is Elizabeth Seton's feast, so there's usually a celebration there. Later in the year, in September, we're planning a Vesper service at St. Peter's Church on Barclay Street in the shadow of Ground Zero, which is the church where Elizabeth Seton was received into the church and made her first communion. There will be lecture series jointly sponsored by Sisters of Charity and several of our colleges, and I know the College of Mount St. Vincent has a few lectures planned for March and later in the fall of next year. There, then down in Emmitsburg, Maryland, there will be many events throughout the year, including retreats, both for members of our communities and for lay folks. We'll also have full weekend, July 31st weekend of 2009, which is the actual 200th anniversary date, where there will be numerous events, including a reenactment of the journey from Baltimore to Emmitsburg. She did it walking and by carriage. I think this time it'll be a little different, but...
She didn't have Amtrak.
Didn't have Amtrak to count on. Not at all.
Good. Well, if you want to get more information, I assume you can go to that website again.
Go to that website. It's www.scny.org, or there's one www.seatonlegacy.org, which is the Emmitsburg, Maryland website for all the bicentennial events.
Well, we want to thank Sister Regina Bechtel for coming in and kind of giving us this history and reminding us of the importance of the legacy of this important American saint. Hope you can come again soon.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Just a reminder that we're back on our weekly schedule, so we'll have a new recording for you interview every week, so check back in. And of course, you can comment on our interviews by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. We want to thank Bill McGarvey, who provided the music for this week's show. He has a new album out, which you can learn about at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.